What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. You going to be in Telluride this year?
Probably in Park City.
Oh, great. We'll see you there.
So what's happening with Glass Box?
Can we talk about something other than Hollywood for a change?
Yeah. Yes.
We're educated people.
Sure.
Tim Robbins' Griffin Mill isn't scheduled to be in town, but Hollywood players big and small will be Chicago-bound as the Second City kicks off its 49th annual International Film Festival next weekend. This week's Film Spotting Top 5 has us looking ahead to the fest. We'll name the five films we're most looking forward to.
And we continue our six-week look at contemporary Korean cinema with Park Chan-wook's I'm a Cyborg, But That's Okay. Park is the director of the cult favorite Oldboy and this year's Stoker. That and more.
Josh, this is a red wine glass. Can I have my water in a water glass?
Such a prima donna. Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM1013. That's offer code FILM1013.
We're also brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and iPod. Listen whenever and wherever you want, just like the podcast you're listening to right now. Audible has more than 150,000 titles to choose from in every genre.
Two quick recommendations here you can find on Audible. I think it's possible, Josh, they've come up on shows in the past, but worth mentioning again, listeners have been fond of both of these books. The first one is A Wilderness of Air, and it's a book by the director, Errol Morris, as you're going to hear. In a moment, spoiler alert, Errol Morris will come up here in the top five most anticipated Chicago Film Fest movies, and this is his book about the trial of Jeffrey McDonald. And I'll just read the end of the description here. It says, in this profoundly original meditation on truth and justice, Errol Morris reopens a famous closed case and reveals that 40 years after the murder of McDonald's family, we still have no proof of his guilt. So if you know anything about Errol Morris, you know that sounds like something right up his alley, and it's one I haven't read myself, but have been encouraged to by many Film Spotting listeners. The other quick recommendation is I, Partridge, We Need to Talk About Alan. This is the fictional memoir of the fictional celebrity and TV host Alan Partridge, played by the great, great Steve Coogan, and that's really all you need to know, I think, about it to want to seek it out. Steve Coogan, always brilliant, and that's his most memorable character. Again, I, Partridge and A Wilderness of Error are both available on Audible.
You can always send your own Audible recommendations to us at feedback@filmspotting.net or post them on the Film Spotting Facebook page, facebook.com/filmspotting. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We've got a great Film Spotting deathmatch poll question coming a little bit later. And we also have everybody's new favorite segment, Larson Recommends. That is where Josh picks a movie that Adam didn't have time to see. And it turns out it's a movie Josh likes, and he recommends it. It's as simple as the title
and
suggests.
And it's not Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, too.
No.
Which you did have time to see.
Which I did have time with my children to see. And it will not be a segment called Kempinar Recommends, I'm afraid. But that's all ahead on the show.
We open with our preview of the Chicago International Film Festival, which runs October 10 to 24. If there were 48 hours in each day and we didn't need to sleep, these are the 10 films Adam and I would seek out at the fest.
It's so strange. It's a lot smaller than I remembered. This place.
You've been here before?
Yeah. He's my cousin, if you can believe it. Our families came over here on a boat together. We grew up here. You know, Bruno and me used to be close. But then it changed. I'm curious. How is it that you ended up working with him anyway?
That's Jeremy Renner and Marianne Cotillard in James Gray's The Immigrant. It's the film that kicks off the 49th annual Chicago International Film Festival on Thursday, October 10th. It's a movie because of James Gray, because of Jeremy Renner and Marianne Cotillard. I am very much anticipating, Josh, but I did leave it off my list of my most anticipated Sith movies, mainly just because it's one of those big special presentations. And there's a few other movies like that that have actually gotten a lot of attention already on the show. We've been previewing in previous episodes, and we left those off as well.
12 Years a Slave, which would be the Steve McQueen film that got a lot of rave reviews, coming out of Toronto, would be one of those. Also, Inside Llewyn Davis, the new Coen Brothers film, of course. Those are big ones, and every year the Chicago Festival does get those. They feel a little bit like leftovers because there's been a lot of word out of other fests about them, but still, for those of us here in the city, it is a chance to see them early.
One more that I also left off was Blue is the Warmest Color, the film that was the most recent Cannes Golden Palm winner, and it's a movie that was, I think, maybe my number one most anticipated movie of the fall when we just did that preview a few weeks ago here on the show. So those movies have all, as we said, gotten a lot of attention here on Film Spotting and elsewhere. We left them off for the purposes of this list. We wanted to pick movies that maybe aren't the big presentations that you may have trouble getting tickets to. These are the movies that hopefully you might have overlooked had you not heard this show. And if you're in Chicago or you're in the surrounding areas you plan to make it in, maybe these are some of the films you can seek out. And I always do feel a little bit bad about this, Josh. I always address it here on the show when we do this preview annually. Part of it is just some civic duty. I feel like here as Chicago-based critics on WBEZ and doing the podcast that we have to give some love, and we should give some love to our local film festival. But I also look at it as a case where everyone out there listening in other states or other countries, whether or not you can see these movies in Chicago, the fact is they may come to a festival near you, or they may just get released on DVD at some point. And again, maybe you would have never heard of them or known to look out for them if it wasn't for this show. So that's my justification anyway for this top five, Josh. Why don't we go ahead and jump right in? What's your number five most anticipated Chicago Film Fest movie?
I'm going to start with an African film, actually. I've very limited experience with pictures from any region, really, of the continent, and the festival is going to offer up a couple of chances to make up for that. The one that looks especially intriguing to me is Grigri. Now, this is spelled, if you're looking for it in the program, G-R-I-S, G-R-I-S, and it's a co-production from France and Chad, directed by Mahamat Salah Haroun, who's one of Africa's more internationally renowned filmmakers. The story here concerns a young man with a paralyzed leg who still spends his nights dancing at a local nightclub, and then he gets involved in the black market after a relative becomes burdened by hospital bills. So one of those smaller ones you're talking about, that this is the first I'd actually heard of it, but still looks like a great opportunity to introduce yourself to some different filmmakers and different stories. That's going to show actually October 13 and 19, so two chances to catch it.
And we will list these movies over at filmspotting.net. If you click on top fives, you can find all these titles. We will try to include as well those Chicago Film Fest dates if you do want to make sure you have a chance to see them. It's funny with these previews, whether it's our most anticipated of the year or the summer or the fall, it is usually the case that I, and often you too, Josh, we tend to pick the movies that are films that come from directors we know really well, or sometimes there are actors involved that we always like to see what they do next. Sometimes, though, it really is just the plot description, and we may get into some of those. I certainly have an honorable mention that fits that bill. When you're reading movies like this and you don't know any of the major players, sometimes just that short synopsis in the festival guide can be enough to hook you. That isn't the case with my number five, though. This is one of those examples where I'm going strictly by the director and his body of work. And the movie is the documentary At Berkeley. The director is Frederick Wiseman, who really, if you were putting together the Mount Rushmore of documentarians, and let's say maybe you start with Robert Flaherty, you'd also have to have on there Frederick Wiseman. And I should have looked this up. He's made something like 40 or 50 documentaries at this point, including Titicut Follies and High School, both movies that were featured in my Cinema Verite class a couple summers ago at the University of Chicago's Graham School. I love High School. I also do like Titicut Follies quite a bit, though it's a very difficult sit. It was his first movie. Nobody really chronicles how institutions work and often how institutions, unfortunately, fail better than Wiseman. He really does show you how people get lost in the machinery of bureaucracy, and he finds them. His movies go and reclaim those people for us. And At Berkeley is a movie that takes place, as the title says, at Berkeley, at the University of California. He shot it during the fall 2010 semester, and he basically had unfettered access to shoot classrooms, administration meetings, any of the goings-on behind the scenes, as well as what the students are seeing in class every day. And I can't say that I was dying necessarily to see a movie about the college experience or about the Berkeley experience, but knowing that Wiseman's going to turn his eye to it makes it a film I really do want to see. I will throw out the caveat, though, that this movie actually ranked a lot higher in my top five most anticipated Chicago Film Fest movies until I saw The Running Time. And Mr. Wiseman has been known to make some epically long documentaries, sometimes two parts. This movie is 244 minutes.
Ooh, that's a commitment.
So if I'm doing the math, what is that, about 4 hours?
I think so.
Yeah, just a little over yeah. 4 hours. So you really are committing to about a weekend in Chicago just to take in at Berkeley. But you know what? Wiseman's worth it. And his films are sometimes hard to see. I'll actually link to his website and some of his films in our show notes at filmspotting.net if you're curious to learn more. But great documentarian filmmaker, and at Berkeley is one I want to see.
Allora, onori il padre e la madre?
Io sì, ma loro non mi onorano a me. Mi danno certe tosse sulla testa.
Si vede che li fai arrabbiare. Le dici le bugie?
Per forza le dico.
Desideri la roba degli altri?
Sì,
e i fiori piccoli nei vasi piccoli.
Right, I always appreciate the revival screenings that they do at these festivals, and this year's Chicago International gives us one that I've never actually seen, either on the big screen or elsewhere. It's Federico Fellini's Amarcord from 1973. It's somewhat autobiographical, of course, as you'd expect, this account of childhood in a small Italian village during the time of Mussolini. This won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film around 73 when it came out, and has a distinction of being called by Ebert as Fellini's final great films, even though he did do a number after this. So Amarcord, a revival screening of that, you can catch on October 19th.
Amarcord, unfortunately, is a Fellini movie I haven't seen and have always meant to catch up with, so the fest would be a good opportunity to do that. I left off one of those screenings, part of its documentary section here at the festival this year, mainly because I just wanted to pick new movies. I didn't go that route like you did. But honestly, if I was picking the one thing at the festival I could go see, it probably would be the screening of Medium Cool, mm-hmm. the Haskell Wexler film from 1968, shot here during the Chicago riots around the time of the Democratic National Convention. It stars Robert Forster. I love the kind of guerrilla filmmaking, the documentary technique there, even though there is a narrative at play as well. And they're showing that, and Wexler still alive is scheduled to be there at the festival. So Medium Cool, kind of fitting with Amarcord, is another one I'd recommend. But that's not even my number four. My number four, Josh, is actually a film called How I Live Now. The director is Kevin MacDonald. It stars Saoirse Ronan, who I love from Hannah, and also Atonement. She's an American teen. She's sent to stay with her relatives in the English countryside. She meets a boy. This sounds pretty normal, but then some kind of political conflict escalates. I didn't want to read too much about the film, and I've seen some differing plot descriptions here, but essentially things get a little bit out of hand, get too violent and chaotic, and she's really fighting for her own survival.
Girls, follow me.
Wherever they take you, find a way to get back here. Promise me.
You can't split us up.
Daisy!
The reason I'm drawn to this movie is the director, Kevin MacDonald. It sounds a little bit like another movie I happen to love a lot more than anybody else in the world, except maybe Kevin MacDonald's mom, and that's The Last King of Scotland from 2006. It was actually my favorite movie of 2006, starring James McAvoy, and we all know the great performance that won the Oscar for Forest Whitaker there as Idi Amin. But it seems like maybe a little bit of a return to that, in the sense that obviously you've got the political intrigue and a little bit of the fish out of water, but there's also this sort of sci-fi apocalyptic thing maybe going on, where it's not just political conflict and violence, it's kind of described as World War III in some of what I've seen. MacDonald made, after The Last King of Scotland, The Disappointing State of Play and The Eagle, starring Channing Tatum. I'm hoping that this is maybe a little bit of a return to form for him. He made the great documentary, and he started as a documentarian One Day in September about the 1972 hostage crisis at the Munich Olympics, and he's one of those guys who I really trust incorporating that documentary style with narrative. I think this is going to come up as a recurring theme now that I'm thinking about it throughout my list. So I'm hoping, as I said, we're going to see some flashes of the old Kevin MacDonald in How I Live Now.
Well, I'm going to go with a documentary for my number three. It's Purgatorio, though this sounds like it's maybe a little bit more impressionistic than information heavy in terms of documentary style. I'll read from the festival description here for it. It says, by turns brutal, beautiful, and eye-opening, Rodrigo Reyes's documentary offers a thoughtful portrait of the U.S.-Mexico border. His wide-ranging aesthetic inquiry incorporates interviews with border crossers, coroners, dog catchers, police, and others on both sides, tying these disparate stories together through stunning imagery that depicts the border as an almost mythic place. So, sounds like a unique approach to me for this subject matter, and there's a couple opportunities to see this one as well, October 22 and 23.
That does sound great. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing our top five most anticipated films playing at the Chicago International Film Festival. It kicks off, of course, right here in Chicago on October 10th. And my number three is a movie called Stray Dogs. The director is Tai Ming Leong. I have to confess, I'm really picking this just based on his reputation among cinephiles I trust. There are so many discerning movie watchers out there that I've gotten to know through film spotting, whether it's other critics or listeners, who really revere this filmmaker. He's a Taiwanese director. He's kind of known as being part of the second new wave of film directors out of Taiwan, including Ho Xiao Shen and Edward Yang. And I haven't seen any of his movies. I know Goodbye Dragon Inn. I know that was a popular film for him, and it did resonate with some audiences here in the States, at least in art house circles. I've heard some good buzz about Stray Dogs. It's a movie about a father and his two children who are kind of struggling to survive in Taipei. They squat in an abandoned building, and he makes a meager salary, the plot description says, as a human billboard.
Mm.
So not something you read every day in a plot description, but he's a filmmaker really known for his visuals and his use of imagery. And again, just going off of what I know about him and some of the things I've heard about this movie, I'm really curious for Stray Dogs, my number three.
Yeah, that's one of those. I forget which festivals, but I've seen that title pop up in festival reports, getting a lot of good word about it. My number two comes from a filmmaker I'm actually familiar with. It's Japan's Hirokazu Koreeda. He made Afterlife, Nobody Knows, and I Wish, just a couple of his titles. This one's called Like Father, Like Son, and it centers on a couple who discovers that their son was mistakenly switched with another child at birth. So essentially what they do, it sounds like, is they trade kids to be reunited with their biological child. Now, this could go either way. I know some people do find Hirokazu to be a bit of a sentimental filmmaker, and it does sound a little bit like a Lifetime movie plot, but I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt on it.
Hmm. Yeah, it does sound intriguing. Something about the subject matter, just as a parent, it's one of those you read the plot description and it makes you cringe. It makes
oh, yeah.
you so uncomfortable
oh, yeah.
that it makes me a little less excited to maybe see it. I will note, though, that it reminds me of a very famous episode of This American Life, and I know we have a lot of This American Life listeners out there, and that may be still my favorite episode of This American Life ever, one that follows that story where that secret is kind of revealed and how the different families deal with it. So a great pick there. My number two is from a director we both definitely know, and the film was called The Unknown Known. It's Errol Morris. Going back to the documentary route, it's a film actually dedicated to Chicago's own Roger Ebert. Errol Morris always had a really strong relationship with him. And if you've seen The Fog of War, his portrait, his one-on-one documentary with Robert McNamara, of course, focusing on his time as Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War, this seems like a companion to that. I don't know whether or not he directly envisioned it that way or not. I haven't read a whole lot about it at this point, but this is a movie that focuses on George W. Bush's Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and really focuses on his time as the architect of the Iraq War. I love Errol Morris as a filmmaker, Josh, because I think his biggest preoccupation is actually probably my personal favorite cinematic subject, and that's truth. Its subjective nature specifically, how words and images can conspire to confound truth just as often, if not more, than elucidate it. And Fog of War was a movie, I'll confess, among the Errol Morris films I've seen, was not one of my favorites.
Really?
I liked it, but could have probably placed four or five other films of his I enjoy more, maybe five or six. This film makes me want to go back and revisit that, see maybe what it was I was missing, because I know a lot of film spotting listeners who really love that film and put it near the top of Errol Morris's films. I want to see how he's going to handle another similarly controversial subject here. I think it's fair to say, knowing a little bit about Morris's politics, that he probably doesn't align himself too closely politically with someone like Donald Rumsfeld or Robert McNamara before him, but I love how he's willing to give these subjects a forum to explain themselves, to make a case for themselves, or to hang themselves. Ultimately, he lets them do it. That's The Unknown Known from Errol Morris.
Yeah, that's the suspense with this one, right? Is to see if there is that moment where, I don't know if catches him is the right word, but where we get that little glimpse, that facade starts to fall away.
Yep.
So definitely a honorable mention for me. My number one is The Harvest, however. And one main reason I want to see this, Michael Shannon, who we both got to see on stage recently at a Red Orchid Theater production of Sam Shepard's Simpatico. He really has an unsettling presence on the screen, as film viewers know. He has that definitely on the stage as well. And so I'm just drawn to whatever it is he's going to do next. He stars in this alongside Samantha Morton, another great actor, and they play a pair of protective parents who keep their sick son isolated from the outside world. Now, aside from the cast, there's also an intriguing director here. It's Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer's John McNaughton. And according to the festival, McNaughton and Shannon are both scheduled to be there for the film's October 19 screening.
Wow. Yeah, that's definitely one I strongly considered. My number one most anticipated Chicago Film Festival movie, again, the fest opens here in Chicago on October 10th, is the movie Closed Curtain from the Iranian filmmaker Jafar Panahi. Panahi is a director, obviously, Josh, we got to know pretty well during our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon, and I'm forgetting now, it's all kind of a blur. Was that about a year ago? I think we did
that? Yeah, I think so.
And we watched two of his films. We watched The Mirror, which was my favorite film of the entire marathon and maybe one of my favorite films of any marathon in the history of the show. That's a movie from, I think, 1997 or 96. And then you've got Offside, which I think we ended the marathon with,
right,
or it was the penultimate film. And that was a really good movie as well. We also liked and reviewed here on the show, if I recall correctly, the 2011 movie This Is Not a Film, which was a movie similar to this one in the sense that Panahi is a director who is now facing a 20-year ban. He is subject to a 20-year ban from making movies in his home country, and he still found a way to smuggle out this film, if you want to call it that. This Is Not a Film, where he was really trapped inside his house trying to sort of stage the movie he would make if he could make a movie, and this movie kind of blends reality and fiction in a way that that movie does, where it's the story of a writer who's working in seclusion and some strangers break into his home, and there's that plot line. But then at some point, Panahi, as we might expect, knowing what we do know about him from the marathon, he finds himself kind of getting into his own work, and the fiction starts crossing over into his everyday life, and it becomes this kind of autobiographical documentary at the same time that it's this narrative piece of fiction as well. But the biggest reason, Josh, for me, it's number one, beside the fact that it's Jafar Panahi, is that this is what film festivals like the Chicago Film Festival are all about. It's really tempting to want to go see the big movies like 12 Years a Slave and Inside Llewyn Davis, but you know what? You're going to have a chance to see those.
Yeah, this might be your only shot for
this
Closed
may
Curtain.
Be your
yeah.
only shot to see Closed Curtain. Right now, no U.S. distribution. Who knows, with his political troubles, whether or not this film will ever be seen in this country or maybe some other countries. So if you're coming to the festival, this is one you almost literally have got to see, because you're going to see the Coen Brothers movie in a couple months. You're going to see, as I said, 12 Years a Slave in a month or two. But this one, you may not have that opportunity.
Yeah, that's really the way to go about a festival like this, for sure.
Those are our top five most anticipated Chicago Film Fest movies, and we will list those titles again on the top five page over at filmspotting.net. What about, Josh, any more honorable mentions, other films that were tough to leave off?
Well, I'd certainly agree with you on Closed Curtain and Stray Dogs in particular, and also one that looked really good is an American film called Bluebird. It's set in a small logging town in Maine, it says. Looks like it's very visually striking, a story of loss and tragedy. It has, in a supporting part, I think, John Slattery from Mad Men, and also Steppenwolf's Chicago Theater Company here, of course, Amy Morton, I believe, has the lead.
For me, I did have The Harvest down here mainly because of Michael Shannon, but I also love Samantha Morton, so putting both those screen presences together is a great thing. I'm very curious about Alan Partridge. I love Steve Coogan, and that's one of his most famous characters, if not his most famous. And then I've got three other titles that did jump out to me, Josh. One of them is called A Thousand Times Good Night. It's a movie about a war photographer named Rebecca, who is badly hurt in an explosion. She comes back to Norway, and
oh, this is Benoist, right?
Her family, there you go. Cut to the chase there, my buried lead. Her family gets a little bit unhappy with her risk-taking in her job and want her to kind of make a choice between them or her career, and it is Juliette Binoche. And the plot description itself sounded pretty interesting, but then you see Juliette Binoche, who really is one of our greatest cinematic treasures. I'm also really curious about a documentary called The Missing Picture that won a prize at the recent Cannes Film Festival, and it goes back to the movie The Act of Killing a little bit, and a movie I mentioned during our discussion of that documentary, Enemies of the People. That documentary, Enemies, is set in Cambodia, and it reflects back on the genocide that occurred during the Khmer Rouge reign. And this movie similarly tackles that, where basically the documentarian says, okay, there are no images out there of the government's atrocities during the Khmer Rouge. They managed to cover them all up. So we're going to recreate that imagery, and through clay figurines and other methods. Again, do you see how this sounds like The Act of Killing?
Definitely,
a little bit?
Sure.
Kind of restaging some of this stuff and reclaiming it. That sounds really fascinating. And the last one I'll mention is a movie called The Pact. And this is the one for me, Josh, that I'm hooked on just based on the plot description. Don't know the director, don't know any of the actors involved, at least not by name, but here's the description. A dark psychological thriller, A Pact tells the twisted story of a contentious love triangle. As teenagers, Paul tricked George into handing over his girlfriend Anna to him. George agrees, on the condition that he can have her back whenever he wishes. After decades of silence, when Anna and Paul have a family together, George suddenly reappears. Strange things start happening to Paul, and it soon becomes clear that George has not forgotten the pact. Sounds creepy.
Yep.
Sounds creepy. So that's one I would also like to see. Hopefully we'll actually have time for a few of these movies here at the Chicago Festival. Again, it opens October 10th, and we look forward to some of the movies you're excited to see, but also the movies you do see. Share some of your thoughts with us about the movies that stood out for you at the festival, or maybe past great Chicago Film Festival experiences you've had. You can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
All right, keep those earmuffs handy. We're not going to have any salty language in Massacre Theater, but Adam and I may do some humming related to the film spotting poll, and it could be painful. Plus, a review of the latest in our Korean auteurs marathon. I'm a cyborg, but that's okay. Stay with us.
Trying again. Born all over again. Without a wish, without a line, without dying, all over again. Trying to stop taking it out on you. Cut the connection. Just to stitch it together.
Quick interruption here, folks. We want to remind you that Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
This episode is also brought to you by Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project, whether it's for your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or other type of film project. And Josh, we heard from a listener who uses Shutterstock, very complimentary of the service. Ron Dawson in Atlanta, Georgia says, I'm a huge fan of the show. In addition to my own video production business, I head up video production for a creative marketing and advertising agency here in Atlanta called Mighty Eighth Media. One of our clients is Pinnacle Bank, a bank that focuses entirely on small local communities around the Atlanta and Athens, Georgia areas. One of their employees had a son killed in the line of duty in Iraq 7 years ago. That year, she organized a donation drive to put together care packages to send to our men and women fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. We produced a video for them to help in the fundraising and donation efforts, and I wanted to include clips from troops in the Middle East. Using Shutterstock, I found the absolute perfect clips. One of the clips I needed was that of a U.S. soldier giving food and toys to local Iraqi children, because the care packages Pinnacle Bank sends includes toys to give away to the local kids. I couldn't believe it when I actually found a clip on Shutterstock that was exactly that. It was as if we shot it to match the voiceover. It was perfect. So if you want to see that video that Ron finished, you can watch it at pinnaclebank.com/troops. Ron says they've been a great resource that's easy to use and reasonably priced. Thanks so much for that testimonial, Ron.
Shutterstock has flexible pricing, and you can choose between individual clips or video packs. Download the clips in HD or just save them with standard definition or even web formats. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Save your video selections you find to your clip box. Once you do decide to purchase, use offer code FILM1013, and new accounts will receive 25% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 25% off new accounts, use offer code FILM1013. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
The blood left my hand, sucking the whiskey out of your hair.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Of course, you know that theme. from Raiders of the Lost Ark, John Williams, the composer there. A little bit later in the segment, we will look ahead to next week's Top 5. We are planning to revisit our favorite movie scores. It's one I think we did here on Film Spotting Josh, but way back in maybe 2005, the first year of the show. I have no idea what my picks were then, and I look forward to going back to that topic with you and also Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune, our resident score expert. He's going to help us out with that show as well. Right now, though, it's time for Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this very heavily bleeped scene.
Hey, Mr. Brigante, it's the second time you turn me down for a drink, man. Well, you don't like my champagne?
Hey, could be.
I don't know, maybe it's a misunderstanding here. I don't know, man. Maybe you don't remember me. My name is
maybe
Benny.
Maybe I don't give a Maybe I don't remember the last time I blew my nose either. Who the f*** are you? I should remember you. Huh? What, you think you like me? You ain't like me, mother. You a punk. I've been with made people. Connected people. Who you been with? Chain snatching, jive ass, modicum, mother. Why don't you get lost? Go ahead, snatch your purse. Come on, take a.
That was effin' Al Pacino as Carlito and mother effin' John Leguizamo as Benny Blanco in Carlito's Effin' Way from 1993. It was written by David Coop and directed by Brian De Palma.
I believe it's Benny Blanco from the Bronx.
Is that
I think
is that
you
what
have
it
to
is?
Actually say that. That's his name.
I also want to issue an apology to you.
We'll get to that. Just wait.
Okay.
We're going to get
I gotta
to
get
that.
This off my chest.
Rose Messer from Naperville, Illinois says the big tie-in, of course, is the 1993 release date. We did share our top five movies of 1993 last week on the show. Another tie-in, writer David Koepp also wrote Jurassic Park, another 1993 treasure. Plus, remember Josh joking about the unjust exclusion of 1993's Super Mario Brothers movie? Well, John Leguizamo, a.k.a. the Adam half of the Massacre Theater dialogue, played Luigi in that ever-so-influential Nintendo adaptation.
Big year for John Leguizamo.
Oh, indeed. Thanks for the show, guys. I loved it, as always. We also heard from Jefferson Hyde in Seattle, and Jefferson is really trying to make a name for himself as the guy who comes up with the best Massacre Theater tie-in emails.
The film is Carlito's Way, released in 1993. The top five on the show was the top films of 93. Bada boom, bada bing, there's your tie-in. However, am I satisfied with one connection? No, I am not. Josh's rendition of Pacino actually sounded a lot more like Samuel Jackson with a really bad cold.
I think that's pretty close.
Is that it?
That was, Josh, I'm going to say a little bit of a disappointment coming from you.
Well, don't you think, like, bad Pacino should be fairly easy. That's what I thought.
Maybe.
And I gave you a bad Pacino.
But notice I can say that being the guy who chickened
well,
out.
Well, of course.
I wasn't going to try
Maybe
it.
There was a reason I wanted to put it on you.
I wasn't going to try it. But you know what? I vow on a future Massacre Theater, you're going to have to revisit Pacino.
Or maybe we should see if you're bad
okay.
Pacino.
You know what? I'll rise to the challenge.
All right.
I'm going to take it.
We're going to look for that. Jefferson goes on, though. Samuel was, of course, in Jurassic Park, also from 93, and perhaps that very speech is included in an obscure R-rated Berserk edition of the DVD somewhere. Another actor infamous for massacring Pacino is Welsh funny man Rob Brydon. Brydon is a frequent collaborator of Film Spotting endorser Steve Coogan, who was also mentioned on the show in relation to his upcoming film, Alan Partridge. I got connections coming out of my ears here. I got like 10 more tie-ins, really, but I don't got time to type them all because Adam's out of order, Josh is out of order, the whole show's out of order.
I believe he means the whole show's out of order.
Oh, man. No way. That was worse than mine.
Oh, that was way better. That was way better.
Listeners will
spotting,
be the judge.
The Film Spotting Deathmatch poll question should be, whose Pacino was better? You would get
By that,
slaughtered.
We mean worse.
You'd get slaughtered. If you want to hear that scene, Josh's really bad Pacino, plus our top five films of 1993 and our review of a really good film, Short Term 12, you can get that show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. Another slow week for Massacre Theater returns.
I just threw everybody off.
Maybe you did. We got to pick something a little more obvious. I don't know that we're going to get to that here in a moment, but still enough entries. Josh, reach in and pick out this week's winner.
That would be Tommy Rylander from Madison, Wisconsin.
Congratulations, Tommy. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with your free six-month subscription to Fandor.com.
I think your dialogue is beautiful. I really do. I love it.
Then why the hell don't you just stand still and say it instead of wandering all over the stage? You're supposed to be looking for your soul, not an ashtray.
I'm tempted to say this edition of Massacre Theater, we should both do our Pacinos.
Maybe
just
we
match
should.
Them up against
Throw
each other.
People off the
set. But this scene will be fun to do as it's written, too. So maybe we'll do it that way. Massacre Theater is presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information is at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
We did get this note from Alexander. I'm going to share this, Josh, in lieu of a Fandor recommendation this week. He said, I recently discovered Fandor is now available in Canada, and it seems like the majority of their library is accessible. I've been trying it out, and I'm loving it. I'm sure your Canadian listeners will love to hear that they can now have access to Fandor. Thank you, Alexander, for sharing that. Didn't have any idea. And yes, hopefully many of our Canadian listeners will check out Fandor. Let's get to this week's scene, the hastily thrown together scene, as somehow we couldn't get our act together this week and actually come up with one ahead of time.
Hasty as in scribbling the lines down on a piece of paper 5 minutes ago.
Literally scribbling lines down. Yes, exactly. But there
is... The pacing might be a little off.
Yeah, there is a tie-in to this week's show, maybe even more to next week's show by way of a little bit of a hint there. Still a fun scene, hopefully, to do, and I think maybe we'll get a few more entries than we've gotten over the past few weeks. Just a few more. Josh, you started off, so I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
All right.
And action.
Hey, you know those girls who live next door to you? You know what I think? I think they're lesbians. That's what I think.
Oh, yeah? What makes you say that?
Well, look at them up there doing all those contortions together and with no clothes on.
Oh, they're just doing yoga.
What?
Yoga. I don't know what it is, but it's yoga.
Yeah, what do they do for a living?
They dip candles.
What?
Yeah, they got a cute little shop over on Hollywood Boulevard. They dip them and sell them.
I can remember when people just had jobs.
Yeah, listen, Harry, in case you lose me in traffic, this is the address where I'm going.
Thank you.
You look great.
And scene.
All right, if you know what film we did just brutally massacre, and I think we probably should have done our Pacino impressions for, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, October 7th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Two people and a secret. The beginning of all conspiracy. More people and more secrets. But if we could find one moral man, one whistleblower, someone willing to expose those secrets, that man could topple the most powerful and most repressive of regimes.
The one, the only, Benedict Cumberbatch there as WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in The Fifth Estate, the new film from director Bill Condon. It is a movie playing at the upcoming Chicago International Film Festival, which we previewed earlier in the show. And Josh, I think if we learned anything from our poll results to last week's question, it's that we must better respect the batch.
Is that what you're calling him?
I think that's what I'm going with.
I don't know if that's respect.
It's kind of catchy anyway. We asked you which performance from a special presentation at this year's festival are you most interested in seeing? Your choices were, and these were good ones, Steve Coogan as Alan Partridge in Alan Partridge, Benedict Cumberbatch, The Batch, as Julian Assange in The Fifth Estate, Idris Elba as Nelson Mandela in Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom, Meryl Streep as Violet Weston in August, Osage County, even though she didn't play it here at Steppenwolf, or, as far as I know, on Broadway, or finally, Donald Rumsfeld playing himself in Errol Morris's The Unknown Known, one of my most anticipated Fest movies. Josh, how did it come out?
Well, people are just stumping Meryl Streep because she didn't originate the role, apparently.
Yeah, she's used to that by now, though. I mean, she never gets picked for these awards, right?
13%, last place. Donald Rumsfeld as himself was in second to last place with 18%.
And we both went that way.
That shows you how much poll we have.
So much for the theory.
Always
that
so worried about influencing.
We bias our audience.
Well, that's out the window. Steve Coogan as Alan Partridge, 21% of the vote. In second place was Idris Elba as Nelson Mandela with 22% of the vote, which means the batch himself won 27% of the vote.
I do like poll questions, though, where you give five options and they're all right around 20%. I mean, it was pretty close.
Yeah, it was close.
You've got a good film. That means you've got a good film spotting poll when there isn't a clear-cut winner. Lots of options there. Eric Dobson wrote in and said, as you said on the show, there's no bad choice here. I'm going with Rumsfeld because I've been on a documentary kick these past few months. Most notably, I viewed a recent Showtime documentary, The World According to Dick Cheney, in which Rumsfeld was portrayed as more pivotal to American foreign policy than I had previously understood. While not a great doc, it did spur my interest in a behind-the-scenes perspective of America's role in a post-9/11 world.
I'm with you, Eric. Paul Foster in Stafford, Staffordshire, UK, said, I'm voting for Alan Partridge, mainly as I've already seen it, and Coogan has now perfected his signature role.
Coogan is so good, even in lackluster movies, and I thought his recent movie, The Look of Love, with Michael Winterbottom, and that's a director I love, that's a collaboration I love. I don't think it's a very good movie, but man, he's really good in that lead role. Andy H. in Melbourne, Australia, says, while there isn't a dud among the options you're giving, I had to go with The Batch. This could really
All
be
right.
the moment
Leave the
he goes from
alone.
being... well-respected to Oscar material. I also think that with a few more examples of his acting chops in the coming months, 12 Years a Slave, the next season of Sherlock, and August Osage County, Cumberbatch could be muscling in on Fassbender as Adam Mancrush material, a bold statement, I know.
He does have a nickname from you.
He does, but he doesn't have Michael Fassbender's smoldering good looks.
No.
And really, that's all I care about Michael Fassbender for.
Does Fassbender have a nickname from you?
Well, I can't share that.
A private one.
I can't share that on air. Thank you, Andy, Paul, and Eric, and everyone who voted in last week's Film Spotting poll question. We hope you'll go to filmspotting.net this week and participate in one of our patented Film Spotting poll death matches. We are giving you a John Williams specific death match this week as we pick two of his iconic scores from two iconic movies that both happen to be in the Film Spotting pantheon. Yes, you probably know where we're going. These movies stay intact here in this deathmatch, but you lose one of the scores, gone forever. So you can only save one. Which one do you save? Josh, we're going to give them the two options, and I believe because our producer likes to torture us and our audience, we have to hum the options.
Another idea I tried to shoot down.
Yes, you did, and somehow failed. So with that, we're going to go in alphabetical order. That means I'm up first. Their first option in the deathmatch is
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Dun, 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun. There you go. Come on.
Beautiful.
Everybody knows it. You all know it, and you can all hum it better than I just did. And then we give Josh the tough, tough task of trying to relive his childhood and give us Star Wars. And scene.
I don't know if that was humming.
No.
But it was making musical noises.
I'm hoping Sam will now cue up how those songs really should sound, maybe underneath us. And
that might help.
That will try and redeem what we just inflicted on you. But that's it. Those are your choices. And yes, we have a feeling this is probably just going to break down along nostalgia lines and your age, whether you grew up mostly with Star Wars or maybe later with Raiders of the Lost Ark. But they're both such great scores. It's a really tough death match. That's the whole point of why it's a death match. We want to know what you think. Vote now at filmspotting.net.
Baby.
What are you doing?
I was just reading emails.
No, you weren't.
She caught me watching porn.
That's it?
Right? Oh!
How do you watch that?
How do you watch all the stupid movies that you watch?
Movies and porno are different, John. They give awards for movies.
They give awards for porn, too.
The multi-talented Joseph Gordon-Levitt there in a clip from the new movie Don John. There opposite maybe the not-so-multi-talented Scarlett Johansson. She's been a little bit of a whipping girl on Film Spotting over the years. She plays Barbara there in that new movie. And Levitt, as I said, is one of those guys who he really caught my attention. Forget the TV work, which I never really watched that show anyway. On the big screen, he was reviewed here on the show way back in 05 in the Greg Araki movie Mysterious Skin. Breakout supporting role there. Difficult watch, but a really good film and a great performance. And then, of course, he's the star of Rian Johnson's Brick later in 2005. And from then on, he's been a guy who's been on the radar of Film Spotting and many Film Spotting listeners. And you see him in movies like 500 Days of Summer and on Saturday Night Live. He's a guy who can do it all. He can be a serious dramatic actor and play those tough roles. He can be a comedian, or he can also be a song and dance man. And here he is in Don John. He really is now trying to do everything and wear every single hat he can, because he's not only the star of this movie, but he is the writer and director as well. Josh, should he continue trying to wear that many hats and make more movies?
Well, what you look for in a film like this is it's promise, generally. I mean, it's the rare actor who's just going to hit it out of the park with a first film. And the thing that's most promising to me is his choice of subject matter. I mean, what a curious, bizarre story he decides to tell. He plays essentially this Jersey Shore type guy named John, who's a ladies' man, but really he's more of a porn man. I mean, that's kind of the central joke, and this is, at least it starts out primarily as a comedy. It's interesting that that's the vein he decides to go in as a writer-director, because the first half hour definitely goes for laughs, definitely in his performance. And Scarlett Johansson, who's effective here, I think, goes for that with her performance too, in these sort of broad, outlandish Jersey characters. And also in the directorial choices he makes in terms of editing and just how he brings us into this guy's world. There are a lot of insert shots. The porn snippets that we get are often used as punchlines as he's describing in voiceover how he lives his life. It's very much a movie built around his routines, and we see that structure. And so he uses insert shots as punchlines there. And there's even a parody, a satire bit where they show a commercial for a fast food commercial during in a football game that this model, bikini-clad model, is almost making love to a codfish sandwich. So there's a lot of satire here about the sexuality, the oversexed nature of contemporary society, and how this one guy in particular has made it such a part of his life that he really can't even function with other people. Even though he goes to a club, part of his routine is every weekend to go to a club for a one-night stand. That becomes less important to him than his porn viewing habits. And so it's just an interesting choice. I think he handles it well. Eventually, towards the end, we begin to hit a lot of the same notes, very obviously. Julianne Moore plays a character he runs into who gets him to rethink not only his relationship with porn, but his thinking about sexuality in general. And I wish the movie showed us more of the things that she says in her dialogue. It's almost like every one of her lines feels like the thesis statement of the film. But he does handle little moments as well that show some of that promise I'm talking about, where you see the hints of this guy coming out of what is really an insular, selfish activity. That's what the movie kind of presents, this idea of porn being something where there's no giving, only taking for this guy, and there's no intimacy there, and it somehow affects also his life with other people, where he's incapable of any sort of intimacy too, because he's accustomed just taking, taking, taking. So there's some interesting stuff going on there. I think he is good in it. And yeah, definitely shows some promise, and who knows where he'll go in terms of topic. That's kind of the exciting thing too, because he could really come out and surprise us with whatever next movie he decides to take on as a director.
So you can say Larson recommends Don John.
I think so. It's a first film, so it has those limitations, but is worth seeking out. I'm a cyborg, but that's okay. I've had a breakthrough, Adam, and I feel confident sharing that with you. Our review of the 2006 Park Chan-wook film, part of our Korean Auteurs Marathon, is next. Stay with us.
Want to jump in for a second here, folks, to share our thank yous this week. We'll be a brief segment. We only have two new donors we're singling out, but we do appreciate all of our monthly subscribers, especially, and everyone who's donated to Film Spotting here recently. We start with a new $5 a month donor, Scott in Edinburgh.
Just another freeloader finally paying the dealer. Wanted to apologize for how overdue this is. I've been listening to the podcast for an embarrassingly long time, and for one reason or another, I've gotten around to sending some of my hard-earned dollars your way. Thanks for the many hours of insightful film discussion you've shared down the years. I really wasn't kidding about embarrassingly long. There's rarely a trip I take without making sure I'm stocked up on episodes to keep me company and pass away hours in planes, trains, or automobiles. As an aside, considering I have a lot of catching up to do, might I suggest another merch run? And isn't it time for Film Spotting mugs? Pretty sure those would sell like hotcakes. Thanks again. I'll try to be less of a lurker in the future.
Thank you, Scott, for your comments and your donation. Yeah, I don't know, Josh. We may be at the point after finally selling out our inventory of T-shirts.
You cleaned out the T-shirts.
We cleaned out the T-shirts heading into the holidays a couple of years ago, I believe, and I haven't thought about really purchasing new ones. I don't know if we want to go with the same design or design something from scratch and go in a different direction. So it's just been so hard to even tape these shows lately, much less think about extra things.
First.
Yeah, like merch. But it's definitely something we need to keep in mind. I will point you to this, though, Scott. The original Film Spotting merch store was through Cafe Press, and it actually still exists. So if you go to filmspotting.net and you click on the merch link, down at the bottom, there's a link to our Cafe Press store. And there is a Film Spotting mug. I happen to own one. There is a coffee mug with the Film Spotting logo on it.
There are some left?
Yeah, it's a one-time order thing. It's kind of order as you go. So there's not really an inventory.
Okay.
You order one, Cafe Press makes
there
it.
There you go, Scott.
They ship it out to you. And I do have a mug, and I'm sure some other listeners do as well. So if you want one, Scott, you really can get one now through that link. One final donor we want to thank this week, and he's been a longtime listener of the show as well. Rolindo is his name. He's in Seattle, Washington. Thanks to our new donors, and thanks to everyone who, as we said, contributes, whether it's financially or if you just go to iTunes and you rate us there, you give us a positive star rating or write some nice words about the show. It really does just take a second or two, and we're getting close to the 1,000 rating mark, Josh. That's our goal here for the end of 2013. So if you haven't done that yet, please do. Just take a second and go over to iTunes and rate us. It really does help us reach new listeners. One other note before we get to our music, Josh, I did want to share here in this bit. It turns out that Joe, our producer here at WBEZ, has been holding out on us. Or maybe he hasn't been holding out on us. I just haven't been paying enough attention. But I found out this week that you can actually hear Film Spotting on 6 different public radio stations around the country.
Yeah, I think you haven't been paying attention because I asked you this a little while
ago.
What other stations are we on? You're like, I don't know, somewhere in Texas.
Yeah, somewhere in Texas. And it turns out it's KDRP, Community Radio, in the Texas Hill Country.
Well, there you go.
So there is that station in Texas, but there's 5 other ones, including WOUB at Ohio University, WRST in Oshkosh, that's the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh, WRIR in Richmond, KSRQ in northwestern Minnesota and the Grand Forks, North Dakota area, and KCPW in northern Utah. We are huge in northern Utah.
Who says all the cinephiles are in New York or LA?
Exactly. So we love that we have some listeners out there, and we'd love to hear from some of those listeners out there on those stations. If you want to help Film Spotting get on more public radio stations, you can actually go ahead and reach out to your local station. Just shoot them an email or give them a call and point them to PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. That's probably the best way for them to discover Film Spotting. So wanted to share that real quick because I truly did just discover this week that we're on 6 other stations other than WBEZ. A final note about our featured music this week. You are hearing songs from Chicago's own Caliphone. That seemed only right, Josh, considering the Chicago Film Festival theme to our show. And longtime listener and friend of the show, Matt Cavanaugh, recommended Caliphone. You're hearing songs from the band's 13th album, Stitches, which was released earlier this month. We played Frosted Tips and then the title track. The band's lead singer and songwriter, Tim Rutili, is also a screenwriter, so a movie connection here, and a director and a soundtrack composer. His debut film, All My Friends Are Funeral Singers, played the festival circuit in 2010. So there you go, another inspired bit of musical picking there from our producer Sam Van Halgren and listener Matt Cavanaugh.
Hi, this is Matthew Vaughn. I am the director of Stardust, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
사람이 어떻게 목요일을 훔치나?
워낙에 말이 없는 그는 틀니만 끼면 갑자기 떠든다. 기계들하고.
여기 목요일 팬티가 빠졌잖아. 월요일은 여기지, 사람아.
사람한테는 악수를 청하는데 몹시도 악수를 하고 싶어 하다가 갑자기 하기 싫어한다.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. We are diverging from our usual format a little bit. Open with the top 5 this week, ending with our Korean auteurs marathon segment. You just heard Lim Soo-young as Young-goon, and Rain, who I think of just as Stephen Colbert's nemesis from old episodes of The Colbert Report, as Il-sun in I'm a Cyborg, But That's Okay.
We are at the midpoint of this Korean Auteurs Marathon, and I think we're finally on somewhat familiar ground here. Although these marathons are meant to serve as our introductions to specific filmmakers, genres, or regional cinemas, we were really going in blind with our first two films, Three Iron from director Kim Ki-duk and Woman on the Beach from director Hong Sang-soo. Neither of us had seen anything else from either filmmaker up until that point. Not so with Park Chan-wook, a director whose films have become notorious enough that his 2003 effort, Old Boy, is being remade by Spike Lee and comes out later this year.
And maybe at some point, at the end of this marathon, in some bonus content, we're going to have to engage in a little battle over, because if you follow Josh on Letterboxd, you know that he did not have the same experience with Oldboy most of us have had with it.
I don't know about most of us.
Most people I know.
I found a few fellow.
A few.
Yeah, that would be good to get to Oldboy at some point. And we've also seen, at least I've seen one other Park film. We even reviewed Stoker, his English language debut on the show earlier this
right.
year. So we have a little familiarity going here for I'm a Cyborg, But That's Okay, which is Park's 2006 film about a young woman named Young Goon who's sent to a mental health facility after she jams a bunch of electrical cords into her wrists, believing that they're going to energize her. The thing is, she actually does believe, as the title suggests, that she is a cyborg. There are a lot of directions our conversation could go with this, Adam. We could compare Park's frenetically inventive camera style to that of Sang-soo, whose Woman on the Beach we both found somewhat lackluster in that department. Yeah. We could debate the way the movie handles mental illness in general. Some might find it cutesy and trivializing. But here's what I really want to know. If we redid our top five movie robot lists, which we discussed probably a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, in relation to Pacific Rim, would Young Goon make yours?
I guess the question is, are cyborgs the same as androids?
Oh, don't bring up that question.
Because if they are anything like androids, we already got enough grief from a few listeners for calling them robots, so I'm not going to touch that, Josh. Nice try, though. I think we will probably talk a little bit about this movie's portrayal of mental illness. I will say right now, though, that's a complete non-issue for me with this movie. And you're right. A lot of directions we could go, because this couldn't be a more different film visually than the Hong Sang-soo movie. And I'll say this, for whatever it's worth, I do prefer this type of film to the static camera we at least get in Woman on the Beach, though I'll readily say not all static camera movies are created equal. So not really a fair statement. We need to see more of his work to really make a judgment there. But I do love the playfulness of Park's camera, the panoply of shots he uses, the angles, the movements. It is similar to Stoker, which, as you said, we reviewed earlier in the year. I was disappointed by. It's similar to that movie in terms of being visually arresting, but I think actually for more purpose here. And I think purpose, of course, is a key word, because it's funny that you bring up our top five movie robots with regard to this movie, because if you remember during that top five, I prefaced my list by focusing on what I think makes robot characters interesting, including some mention of HAL from 2001, which is that they have an objective. Usually, of course, they were designed that way. They're wired a certain way. They have a task they're trying to achieve, and they're not going to be deterred from it. And sometimes that objective and that determination has human consequences, and that's where we get the drama. So what's another word for objective? It is the word that comes up over and over again in this movie. It's purpose. Remember how many times that the Young Goon character sees in her memory this recurring vision of her grandmother being taken away because she suffered from her own mental illness and thought she was a mouse, and the mom, the daughter to the grandmother, eventually sent her away. And she's constantly saying in the dream, the purpose of existence is, and that she keeps getting cut off. So you have this character who thinks she's a cyborg, who is constantly trying to fill in that blank and figure out what her purpose is. And I guess I'll spoil it a little bit for people who haven't seen the movie, though this really doesn't spoil anything. I think ultimately what this movie gets at is the purpose of existence is living for someone else, having compassion and sympathy for other people. It may sound a bit Pollyannish, it may be a little bit obvious, but if you look at this movie and you see the actions that Il-sun takes because of his love, because of his fondness for Young Goon, it's really all summed up in a scene near the end of the film where he's trying to get her to eat. She won't eat because she says she's a cyborg, and of course she can't eat human food, and she is willowing away. She's deteriorating, and he is so determined to get her to eat that he comes up with this invention, and he says, I'm putting in your back this thing called a rice megatron to get you to eat. It's going to process the food into food that you can handle. And if you really do break that down, this is an example of this character showing his love for her through actions.
It's a very romantic scene.
Just words. It's a really, really romantic scene. And it also counters, actually, her mom character, the one who sent away the grandmother. There's a key scene with her near the end of the film where she's saying how you can't just live for yourself. You can't be so selfish. But that's all the mom does. And that's the irony there. But if you look at this movie, Josh, and you bring in a movie like Three Iron, which is another film that has some wacky characters in it who are on the fringes and who, I don't know if they're mentally ill, but you could certainly make the case that they are. These movies have such a roundabout way to get at these humanist messages, but they ultimately do get there, and I do find the characters very sweet and very interesting. And by the end, I guess I do ultimately fall for that message.
Wacky is where this could have gone wrong. And somehow Park is able to straddle that line where it's very eccentric. There's very odd behavior. And at the beginning, I thought maybe it was going to go that way, where some of the other patients at this mental health facility were just going to be used for their one idiosyncrasy.
Mm-hmm.
And often their visual gags in the background where they'll be literally rolling across the
which
floor.
Which cracked me up, I have
as
to say.
Kind of a, it's funny, it works in the moment, but it also brings up that concern, which you sometimes have with movies set in a facility like this. Okay, are they just going to use the mental illness for laughs or something that's really trivializing a real world horror? And this movie, I think, handles that very well. And there are a couple reasons. You mentioned one, and the grandmother figure. And she's a relatively small part in the film, but she also kind of shadows over all of it, not only because she has that connection to purpose for Young Goon that you talked about, but she is the one who's rooted in some sort of outside reality too. So we get a sense of why Young Goon is struggling so much with these delusions. They're not just quirky traits, which they are in some other films set in a place like this. They're really driven from real world experiences, also family history, which is a very crucial aspect of mental illness. And so the movie nods to these things just enough so that the quirkiness has a level of heft to it that I did really appreciate. The other is the performance by Soo Jung Lim as Young Goon, because this
and Rain's very good too.
I really liked Rain. He's like a pantomime almost in this part, and it works. It works quite well. But Soo Jung Lim has what could have easily been a freak role. I mean, this look she has with some sort of fright wig, the short bangs, her eyebrows are
bleached.
The black
hair, but the bleached eyebrows. Yeah,
bleached eyebrows. And she's often wearing her grandmother's. These are the way the grandmother echoes, right? She's not in a lot of scenes, but Young Goon wears the dentures, and it also gives her this bizarre look. So she has these elements, yet at the same time, she always seems to be somehow connecting to that humanity underneath. So what we do then is we recognize that her sadness, which we see, her fear, which we really see, and her confusion, all of that feels very real to me and not just quirky or idiosyncratic.
Yeah, I think you hit it dead on. I think that what makes this movie ultimately work is, despite how ostensibly quirky the movie is, and there's no doubt that term could be applied to a lot of what goes on here, and even going back to Three Iron a little bit, which I invoked earlier, no matter how bizarre the specific conditions are, what made that movie work and what makes this film work, though I think I probably still like Three Iron a little bit better, is that ultimately the quirk is grounded in something real, real fears, real trauma, just as you touched on. His whole psychology, the Rain character, is driven by his fear of vanishing. This notion that he's someday just going to disappear, he's going to become a dot. And I love that notion because I think it gets back to this idea of what's your purpose? Like, why are you here? Why do you exist? And his fear is that someday he's not going to exist. He's just going to disappear. He's going to be a speck, as if there's no trace of him left on the planet whatsoever. And of course, she too, not only is worried about what her purpose is, but if you go back to the beginning of the film, what we see of her existence before the attempted suicide, which is what they deem that when she plugs herself into the wires, and that is kind of a hard scene to watch. But if you look at where she's at, she's in this almost THX 1138 environment, right?
Yeah,
where everything is stale, everything is white and antiseptic, and they're all wearing the same outfits, the same uniform, and they're all doing the same tasks. And it kind of feels like she's a cog in a machine, that she's someone who has kind of vanished, even though she's really there. She's just part of this system, and any sense of individuality has been taken from her. So that's where her real fear is. But then that real trauma that comes from her grandmother really did vanish. One day she just disappeared. Yes, she had some issues. Even Young Goon recognized that, but she loved her and she showed her love for her through her actions. The mom only said it through the words again, that discrepancy. And one day the mom just says, you know what? I can't handle this anymore. I'm having them take her away. So that obviously would be traumatic for a young woman. So I love how grounded it is. But that other question about the portrayal of mental illness, for me, it was never a concern, even in those really quirky, absurd scenes with the goofy things going on in the background where people are moving in a way that they would never move in any kind of real mental institution. That didn't bother me because right from the beginning of the film, the tone is firmly established and it's consistent the whole way through. It starts with the most Danny Elfman-like score I've ever heard that wasn't composed by Danny Elfman.
Hey,
This seems straight out of a Tim Burton movie. And like a Tim Burton movie, you know right away the whole movie is going to be darkly comic. Everything's going to be just a little off kilter. There is going to be that absurdity. So there's this fantasy aspect to the film, Josh, I think, from the outset. And just based on that, if you plug into that right away, no pun intended, if you do get in tune with that, I don't think there's any way you can be offended by its portrayal of mental illness, because you know that this is a fantasy world and not in any way, even though it's grounded in reality, it's not trying to reflect an actual mental institution.
Well, and because the movie gets that tone right, which we both agree that it does, then it allows Park to go into all of these flights of visual whimsy that we're on board with and we buy and we find really endearing. And one of these is the way Yung-Goon will measure her energy level by looking at her toes, and each toenail will light up. If they're all lit up, she's at full power.
Yeah.
I love that touch. I love the one where another patient believes that rubbing a pair of fuzzy socks together while she's laying on her bed will allow her to fly.
Yeah.
And in these scenes, the movie enters into those delusions and creates them so that they're real. Now, there's an interesting balance going on here. And I think the movie's position is right squarely in the middle, which is key to what makes it work. It's not really blithely endorsing these delusions for their visual kick, in other words, but it's not comically demonizing them as well, in a sense that there's something hilariously wrong with these people. It finds that sweet spot, and it's really reflected in the character of Il-sun, played by Rain, because he's in an interesting position here. He recognizes that Yung-Goon's delusions are delusions, especially when it comes to the eating situation.
Right.
Yet, he at the same time fully gives in to his own paranoia and his own absurd, to us on the outside, beliefs. And so somehow he's able to balance these two, and I think that's right where the movie is too.
Absolutely. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're wrapping up our discussion of the third film in our Korean auteurs marathon. It's from director Park Chan-wook. It is called I'm a Cyborg, But That's Okay. And I do love that point, Josh, because that's also something I jotted down. It had never really occurred to me before, but now that I think about other movies that deal with mental illness, you see this same idea crop up, which is that people who are suffering from some kind of illness, they tend to recognize the quote-unquote craziness in others, but not see it in themselves whatsoever. It's like, oh, wait, I'm perfectly normal. What are you talking about? But in someone else, they go, wait a second, yeah, they're off their rocker. And you see that in this movie for sure. I will admit, despite the tone that I'm completely saying worked for me and made sense, there is something difficult about watching one of the scenes, the extended scene where she starts mowing down people, because she is, and we'll mention this a little bit more in detail here, she is trying to get some vengeance on the people in the white coats who took away her grandmother. So at this hospital, she has these flights of fancy where her fingers turn into guns, and she shoot some people.
Well, this is the flip side of the purpose of existence.
Exactly.
It's not being nice and caring for people.
Exactly.
Her purpose is murder to
one
degree.
And there's no doubt that Park has some fun with those scenes. And there's one or two of them, but there's an extended one that is a difficult watch, just because I think now in this culture, having seen so many scenes of this on the news, having heard so many tales of people walking into schools or other institutions and mowing people down, that even in this absurd fantasy fairy tale, that is very tough to watch. Now, I don't think that that should be off limits. I don't think that those disturbing scenes should be off limits in a quirky movie or in any movie just because they bother us. But it did bother me.
You know why I think that scene in particular is bothersome? Think about the camera angle there. Throughout this film, the camera is very active, moving quite frequently between characters, taking
sometimes
different
off
positions
to the side,
of them.
More voyeuristic, but
in that,
that
scene,
one,
it's almost from the point of view of a surveillance camera.
Yeah.
It's very static. It's from above, and we see her action across a whole field with a number of victims out in front of her, and that echoes a lot of news footage we sometimes see when these incidents occur. So,
Certainly,
you know, the film was made well before the rash of recent incidents, but I thought about that as well.
Yeah, if you've seen Old Boy, though, or if you've seen Lady Vengeance like I have, and I still need to see Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, the third film in the Vengeance trilogy from Park Chan-wook, it is interesting that this film is considered an anomaly for him, and I can see why. It's not nearly as dark. It's much more absurd, as we've touched on, and much more comedic. But there is still that revenge element to it that's kind of fascinating to watch. The notion that she wants to punish the people that took away her grandmother and really wants to do it to the point where she asks the Il-sun character, who is known for being a kleptomaniac, he's a thief, she asks him, can you take away my sympathy? And I do just love that idea that maybe what ultimately separates us from being purely vengeful creatures is just that idea that obviously if you can sympathize with someone, if you can have any empathy whatsoever for another person, it then makes your objective, the purpose of your existence, that much harder to actually carry out. So he is still, in a weird way, dealing with this theme of revenge.
Well, I saw it in the same vein as Old Boy as well, because I think there is a blitheness to the use of violence in both films. And maybe that's something that we can get into if we do have a chance to talk about Old Boy in particular. But that was definitely a common denominator for me.
That's I'm a Cyborg, but that's okay. Again, the third film in our Korean O'Tours marathon. We will get to the fourth film in the marathon in a couple weeks here on the show. So you have a little bit of time. I believe this is a movie, The Chaser, from director Na Hong-jin, that is playing via Netflix Instant. If you want to seek it out there, that's a thriller. And I know a lot of people are big fans of this movie. I'm really excited to finally catch up with it. You can send any comments about our marathon if you've been playing along. We'd love to hear from you. Email those, along with any other comments about the show, to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. Or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and @Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in limited release, opening here in Chicago this weekend, the movie Concussion. And here's the plot description we have, Josh. Speaking of provocative plot descriptions, after suffering a head injury, Abby decides to become Eleanor.
Oh, it's a nicer name.
Yeah, I guess. Our Children, this is a Belgian film that reunites Oon Profet's Niels Arstrup and Tahar Rahim, and they were so good in that Jacques Audiard film. It's a drama about a young family oppressed by the husband's father. There's also Parkland, that is set at Dallas's Parkland Hospital on the day of Kennedy's assassination, with Zac Efron, Tom Welling, and James Badge Dale. You know I'm a big James Badge Dale guy. He's been a scene stealer. I've singled him out here on the show fairly recently. And
the badge? Can we go with the badge?
Well, you know what? I like it. We got the batch and the badge, and I'll put them up against each other. So
oh boy.
Take that, everyone who loves the Cumberbatch. But that's a movie, Josh, that had no idea about until I saw this description. And I guess, you know what, you can just keep coming at that Kennedy murder, that Kennedy assassination, in a lot of different ways. This seems like a fairly inventive one. I'm curious to see what Parkland is all about. Opening in wide release, the long-awaited sci-fi film from Alfonso Cuarón with George Clooney and Sandra Bullock, Gravity. Also, Runner Runner opens, dismissed by one critic, Josh, as the devil's advocate of online gambling. And I don't know how that can't be a good thing.
So that means there's some bad Pacino in it.
There may be an opportunity to bust out some Pacino, so maybe we'll have to talk about that. Alas, that is not our plan. We are planning to discuss Gravity, a movie that doesn't have a whole lot of dialogue there in space, so there seems to be a fair amount of music.
It's interesting how it's used,
yeah,
I'll say that.
Yeah, you've seen Gravity.
Yeah,
I haven't yet.
I can't wait to talk about this. I've been sitting on it for a while.
Yeah, so Gravity, perfect tie-in with our top five film scores.
Definitely.
Again, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune will be here for that.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music comes from Chicago's own Caliphone. It's from their new album, Stitches. You can find more information at caliphonemusic.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.